Time,
That's what I
isn't
thought. I mean, you know.
it?
Good morning,
Right now.
everybody. It's a little after 9:30. Let's see if we have
I think
a
we do.
quorum, shall we? Can we ask that folks be seated, and we will start the roll in 30 seconds. Marcy, what do you say? 30-second warning. Mark Ross. Calling Mark Ross.
Get in here, Mark.
I believe. Do we have Vice President-elect of El Salvador in the House before we start the meeting? Welcome, sir. We're happy to have you with us this morning.
Good morning, everybody. It's a great honor for me to be here.
Buenos dias.
It's an unexpected visit, so I am not prepared to say the proper words, but anyway, I feel very impressed about the building, about the function that you're doing. Most of the impressive things is that all the wood that you are using are recycled, and that means that we are taking a lot of care for the environment, which is a big deal in our countries and in the worldwide problem. And I'm glad that things like that can be presented as a model that we can use the goods of the planet, because we have only one planet. We have no Mars yet, no moon, so it's the Earth. So we have to take care of the Earth. So let me wish you the best. I know that you're working, and I don't want to interrupt you, but thank you for giving me this moment to share with you. As you probably know, we had election in El Salvador last February the 3rd. We were elected. The president, the new president, Mr. Nayib Bukele, it's a young man. It's 37 years old. Probably the first millennial in the Americas to be elected. He's committed to the new agendas for this new world. He also talked about the fourth industrial revolution, committed to innovation, taking care of the environment. So for me, it's a great opportunity to see this example. How can we manage new technologies in order to improve our quality of life? Transportation is a big deal. Pollution, the contamination, the cities, all these problems that you have been managing and giving examples, not only to the state of California or the United States, but also for the world. So thank you very much for allowing me to be here, and I wish you the best.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Hey, David, you have something to do with this?
Pardon? Just a
little. Yes, I figured David had something to do with this.
Well, we're grateful to have you here. We share one planet, indeed. We share pollution. We share a need to protect the climate. And so we're grateful to have you come and visit us this morning. So thank you so much. Yeah. Marcy, could you conduct the roll, please?
On the roll for the Stationary Source Committee meeting of April 29th, 2019, Director Bowders. Director Canepa?
Here.
Director Joya?
Here.
Director Groom?
Present.
Director Miley? Director Ross?
Here.
Director Sparing? Director Wagon Connect?
Here.
Director Zane?
Here.
Committee Vice Chair Mitchoff?
Here.
Committee Chair Sinks?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Wonderful. Thank you. And we can stand for the pledge.
John, can you lead us in the flag?
The El Salvadorian flag. It's upstairs.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We got the job done. Okay. So we'll start with public comment on non-agenda matters, oral communication. Is there anybody who we have no cards? Very good. Then I will take a motion on the minutes, item 3.
I'd move the minutes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Then that passes. Next, we have up number four, an update on monitoring activities at refineries and in nearby communities. Who's got this?
Chair Sinks, I'd like to introduce Jerry Bovey, who heads up our source testing group, and he's going to give you an update on where we are on air quality monitoring in a near refinery and in a near refinery communities.
Great. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Chair Sinks, members of the committee. I am here to give you an update on, I believe this is the wrong presentation, no?
Could you please speak into the mic? I'm having a problem hearing you.
Certainly. Yeah.
Thank you.
There we go. So I'm Jerry Bovey. I'm the manager of the source test and performance evaluation sections here at the Air District. I'm also the acting director of meteorology and measurement at the moment. And I will be giving you an update on monitoring activities at refineries and nearby communities. Just a brief background on Regulation 1215 monitoring. The board took a great step forward in establishing a first-of-its-kind monitoring requirements for refinery fence lines in adoption of Regulation 1215. This approach was actually duplicated or at least led to South Coast Air Quality Management District and state regulatory monitoring requirements that were developed based on the 1215. It leverages advanced open path measurement technologies to expand areas of fence line coverage, which is a step forward from point monitoring approaches which had been conducted in the past. It's also driving installation of monitoring in the communities around these refineries, not directly incorporated into the rule itself, but resulted from the rule development process. Prior to adoption of Rule 1215, we were already conducting significant monitoring activities at these refineries and in the refinery communities. That included in-facility monitoring, continuous emission monitoring at the sources, source testing, leak detection and repair programs. We were also conducting monitoring within the communities at that time, ground level monitoring. Part of our network included monitoring stations for H2S, SO2. Those are still active. And additional monitoring sites within our air monitoring network. We also conduct incident response activities at these refineries when something happens, which is more informative to lead other agencies who are lead agencies in the response effort and not necessarily part of 1215 activities. Current facility emissions monitoring, source monitoring is what is conducted currently. We measure for defined composition and emission parameters from individual sources. Continuous emission monitoring systems that are installed on individual process devices. Source testing, which is more directed so that we can go out there and look at specific criteria and toxic air pollutants. This can identify both the normal and upset conditions at the refineries. Obviously, the continuous emission monitors are very useful to that, but they only measure for compounds at particular sources and specific to particular pollutants. Also, at these refineries, we're doing ground-level monitoring, and there were current fence line monitoring systems in place prior to 1215. Which define chemicals and emissions produced near ground level from the facility. These chemicals and emissions are really fugitive in nature, typically. We do see some source at these source level emissions at these stations. But they're typically for ground level activities, things that happen at the ground. They're best for steady state conditions with non-heat emission sources near ground level. I promised I wouldn't get into the discussion of plume dynamics and bore you with that. Yeah, some other day. So.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so it's best. So by saying that, we're talking about fugitive emissions that are in the breathing zones at the ground level that you would happen to see. These systems are affected by other nearby emission sources. So when we're looking at any results generated or data generated from these systems, we need to weigh it against other sources of pollution which could actually be affecting those measurements that are potentially not part of the refinery if we're trying to focus on the refinery itself. So the rule 1215 monitoring requirements. There's a fence line component to the monitoring, which includes, as a requirement, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylenes, and hydrogen sulfide. These are the required components that must be monitored with the fence line systems. SO2, alkanes, 1,3-butadiene, and ammonia are pollutants that must be considered when evaluating the monitoring network, the design that they're actually looking to put together as part of the monitoring plan. The Air District has released guidelines, I believe it was 2016, if my memory serves, but I could be wrong, for monitoring plans and network design for these fence line systems. The monitoring plans, as part of the component, must include a quality assurance project plan, or QAP, as we like to call it.
A what?
QAP. Yeah.
Thank you.
But I won't bore you with acronyms either. Quality assurance project plan. So, and what that lays out is the quality systems that must be in place and the standard operating procedures to ensure that the systems are going to be are operating effectively and providing accurate, good data. And the reason for that is many, but one of the primary reasons is that it's important that this data is publicly available. It's part of the regulation, and including context for what the data represents, or what's happening at the refinery, which could have caused an incident or spike in some particular emission level. So it's very important that we make sure that the data that's being produced is of a quality that's going to be good enough that we are confident that we are informing the communities in a responsive and accurate way. We don't want to provide information that may be inaccurate to them. Community ambient monitoring air systems, although they are not part of the actual 1215 rule, we are going to be installing these systems, ambient air stations, in the refinery communities as a direct result of the rule itself. So it led, the process of actually putting this together led to the requirements, or led to the we saw the need for these monitors in the refinery communities, and that was followed up by the Assembly Bill 1647, which then incorporated that requirement into their standards as well. Ambient air pollution, just as a very quickly, I wanted to throw this slide up there just so I could, speak quickly to the complexity of what it takes to actually put in an air monitoring station. Levels of air pollution in the community are affected by a lot of things, as you know. Natural background, emissions from combination of common sources, cars, home heating, restaurants, other types of commercial operations, and unique sources, within the industrial facilities themselves, refineries, cement plants, things of that nature. It's also affected by transport from other areas from outside our air basin and within our air basin. It's affected by meteorology, both local meteorology on a short time scale, 1 hour, 1 day, 1 week, and long-term meteorology, what's happening over the long term. Chemical reactions that happen within the atmosphere, topography of the area. Air pollution levels, it's characteristic, the air pollution levels are characteristic of a chemical soup, complex mixtures within the atmosphere. There's competing reactions, there's competing processes that vary widely in time and space. So all of these things need to be considered when actually trying to site a monitoring station. The usefulness of the monitoring station is maximized when it's designed and the site selected with specific data objectives in mind. What are we measuring? Why are we measuring it? How is this data going to be used? All feed into that. So factors affecting ambient air monitoring measurements. Location obstructions. Are there buildings nearby? Source contributions from distance from those sources. How far away are you? How much is it dispersed? How concentrated is it when you actually measure it? Meteorological conditions over time, the prevailing wind speed and direction, which can change significantly on short time scales and long time scales. Topography, again, the chemical composition within the atmosphere, what's happening, you know, photochemical reactions. Some species are short-lived, some are long-lived. And specific pollutants of concern. In this case, we're talking about the refineries themselves and specific pollutants which could be emitted from these refineries. Other considerations is the ability for monitoring location for long periods of time. We need a host site that is going to be able to accommodate our needs for years or decades. Power requirements. Sometimes you can drop the power from a pole that's nearby. Sometimes you may need to trench 100 meters, 1,000 meters in order to gain adequate service to the air monitoring station in order to get power to it that's adequate. Security. We can't have these monitoring stations in areas that are going to be prone to tampering or prone to any type of security threat. And we need access, in some cases 24/7 access to the facility so that we can go and we can calibrate, we can troubleshoot problems. Monitoring in the refinery communities, it raises some complex challenges. Some additional things that we need to look at in addition to what we would normally look at when just selecting a site as part of our monitoring network. We're trying to select instrumentation that's going to be focused on refinery emissions and what we could expect to see from the refinery. That includes things like alkanes, aromatics, polyaromatic hydrocarbons. We're also looking at the regular criteria pollutants, NO2, CO, particulate matter, and H2S. We're trying to focus the community monitoring effort around refineries on the areas that are not currently represented and likely to be impacted by the refinery emissions on a regular basis. So we're going through a significant process of analysis and community input in order to select areas that are going to be representative both from standpoint of what the community wants and is looking for and that meets all of our regular statistical and meteorological conditions and site location conditions that are going to be an effective site. This includes the things I mentioned before, security, power needs, long-term lease availability, but then most importantly, like I said, we want it to be representative of the community. We want to provide data that's going to be informative, that's going to help us to provide information to that community, concentration levels, things like that. Fence line monitoring timelines and issues. Fence lines, the fence line systems are scheduled to be operational in June 2019, unless there are obstacles beyond the refinery's control. Three refineries had previously operated fence line systems. They were not currently part of Rule 1215. They are going through the process of bringing those systems up to spec so that they will be adequate for us as part of the 1215 program and provide data of quality that of a level that we would like. Monitoring plans have been approved for all of the facilities, so the locations and the paths of where they're putting the fence line systems have been approved. We're currently in the process of reviewing the quality assurance project plans. I won't say QAP again, in order to identify and make sure that the quality systems are going to be adequate for the data needs that we have. We're working with the manufacturers, or we had been working with the manufacturers, to address the needs and technical issues related to implementation. That included vetting different types of instrumentation, the types of instruments that we were going that would provide the type of the data that we needed, the concentrations, things like that. Working with the refineries to define the operational parameters and quality objectives so that we can make sure that their quality assurance project plans are comprehensive enough to actually ensure accurate data. Air monitoring stations at in the refinery communities. We held some meetings in February, March, public workshops in 2018 to get community input and provide information. We got the community's feedback on where they thought the monitoring should take place within these communities. We're placing priority currently on communities that aren't well represented, so our priority right now is Benicia, near the Valero refinery, to select a location and get a community monitoring station in place. Part of this process is leveraged activities associated with AB 617 in these communities. Although 617 is a separate program, it's distinct. There's a lot of information gathering and things that that we can utilize in both programs, and they can feed off of each other. In particular, we're going to leverage the AB 617 monitoring in Richmond to provide additional information, gain steering committee input. So what I mean by that is that the process in Richmond for the Rule 1215 monitoring, community monitoring system, air monitoring, can be enhanced and improved by the AB 617 process. So what we're doing in all of the communities is we're looking at the emissions and the meteorology of the individual refineries. We're identifying areas of likely impact, start looking for station acquisition and build out. And we're focusing on the representativeness of the data in addition to the community input where they think the site should be. This all feeds into the complex analysis that we go through in selecting a site. The site selection analysis is near completion for all the refineries, communities, except for Richmond, which, like I said, we're waiting a bit to get some AB 617 monitoring data back because that can feed into our decision-making process both at the community level and from a technical standpoint on what the best location would be to place this monitor that would be most representative. And we're currently working to finalize the site selection in Benicia, which we hope to have completed very soon. Just quickly about 617, because it seems like every presentation mentions 617 in a little bit these days. It dovetails with monitoring in these refinery communities. So we can expand and use all the approaches to identify and characterize local pollutants and where they originate. So all of the activities, the monitoring activities associated with AB 617 can, what I mean by this is it can feed into the process of where we put the community monitor for 1215. The information that's going to be produced is going to be utilized to help us pick the most adequate site. The results may be developed to, may be used to develop an action plan to reduce and ultimately eliminate disparities in air quality from place to place. So it'll feed into our overall knowledge of the air quality in the local scale in this community. We're going to work with communities to identify shared vision and to develop a plan for community air monitoring campaign and the action plans. So with 617, as with 1215, we want community involvement. We want to talk to them. We want to get their feedback. Although ultimately the site would have to meet our own meteorologic or our own siting criteria, getting the community feedback so that we can help identify and include that within our analysis is very, very important to us. Just, I throw these maps up here just as a quick reference of the process that we have gone through in selecting sites. This is a map that was actually presented at the community meeting for Richmond, the workshop in 2018 for the community air monitoring station. The community could come up and look at this map and actually show us the locations that they thought were of significance to them, which helps feed into our decision-making process. We can then compare that to our what we know of these communities and where the pollution is coming from, and compare it to things like this, our wind analysis, our meteorological analysis, to determine if what location would best serve the needs of the community and provide us the information and data that we need in order to actually characterize that community effectively, which is one of the most important parts of this. That's what I got for you today. Any questions you have?
Wonderful questions. John.
Thanks for the presentation. Just a couple questions. On your category, when you talk about the three refineries that currently have fence line systems that are not regulated as part of 1215, it was my understanding, at least in the case of Chevron, that there was going to be some discussion whether any of those would be incorporated into the 1215, assuming it met the standards of 1215. So that's my first question. I'll ask my next one. But why don't you, if you can talk about how any of the existing fence line systems would be rolled into 1215, again, assuming they meet whatever guidelines we require them to meet.
Yeah, and that's true. What we did was look at the systems that they actually had in place.
Right.
We vetted them against the standards that we are currently applying for 1215 to make sure that they met the quality objectives and could meet the detection levels that we were expecting from 1215, including the data reporting requirements and the to the website. I think we're shooting for every 5 minutes. We need to have a rolling average updated to the website to inform the community, inform the public in the areas, the agencies in the areas.
So would we, and then any of the systems that are currently in place that were installed by a refinery or a refinery in conjunction with the local community, the protocol will be that the air district then controls the monitoring if it becomes part of the 1215 network?
The refineries themselves would be operating the monitors.
Under all the 1215 monitoring plans?
Director Joya, the fence line monitors are controlled by the refineries themselves.
With certain with the protocols.
With
that
the
are
protocols,
right.
And that's why the quality assurance project plan is really important.
Right.
The community monitors will be operated by the Air District.
Okay. So, and 1215 has both fence line and community monitors.
We colloquially refer to the community monitors and the refinery communities as 1215 monitors because we made the decision to take over.
Right.
The Air District would take over the operation of those refineries as we were doing the 1215 process.
So what's the time, you know, folks ask, when's the timing of when all of these are going to be up and fully operating with real data online?
Are you referencing the fence line monitor specifically?
Talk about fence line and community. So for both.
Okay.
Fence line monitors are all scheduled to be up by June of 2019. There have been a couple of the refineries have asked for extensions due to permitting issues, construction permitting issues, which we have granted, which could put it off an additional few months.
So we're talking by later this year, the fence line, and that includes Chevron, because what we're waiting on Chevron are the community monitors, because it's part of AB 617, right?
So again, we have to separate the two.
Yeah.
Fence line monitoring is what Jerry's talking about now. The fence line monitoring is what we expect to have up later this year, and then the community monitoring, there's various timelines.
Right, but my question was the community monitor, the fence line monitoring at all five refineries.
Yeah, we expect to have that up this year.
Got it. And then that means the data will be in real time starting at that when fence line monitors are up.
Virtually real time, as Jerry explained, that we're refreshing the data
every five minutes. Yeah, real time and every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the timing for the community monitors?
The community monitors are a little bit, they take a little bit more time due to the complexity of the siting criteria.
Right.
Both because of the community involvement and because we're looking at a larger array of pollutants for those monitors, which takes some time to vet instrumentation for those air monitoring systems. Just a date?
I think it's important to understand a range of date. What's the goal we're working toward?
Well, I think it's important, especially in terms of the Richmond community, that the community is asked to have input on this.
No, that so I get it. Yeah, I've been going to every 617 meeting. Yeah. I think that's a good thing. The community will have input since it's working on
617. Yeah, that makes the timeline a little bit
Right, I get that. Flexible. But for the other non-AB 617.
To give you a rough estimate, we're looking at about 2 years in order to get these systems up.
So community is going to be in 2021, it sounds like, and the fence line by later this year. I'm just trying to get a sense because we all get asked that. I get asked that, right, in Contra Costa. So Karen as well, sure. Okay, thank you.
Director Wagon Connect. I'm just trying to my question is more general. We in Napa had a monitor. Our monitoring station was right down in the middle of town, and people kept complaining about that that there'd be a lot of pollution coming just from the street stuff that was in that area. They moved the monitor out to an area that's a little more open. And people, you know, I would call and say, they're complaining about the monitor is skewed and we don't really have that bad an error, you know, especially when it comes to the wood burning. They were complaining about that. How do our monitors are they able to parse the wood burning? And when we moved it, now that we've moved it to the more rural, a little more rural area, is it how do we norm the measurements that come out of there, so that it's not totally inconsistent with the other monitor station that we already had? I don't know.
I'm just trying to consider your question here so that I can make sure I'm answering what you're asking.
Well, I think on the specifics, we can come back to you and give you an idea as to how it's measuring versus the other one. You know, in general, in our monitoring stations, we're not doing speciation for the different types of carbon. We have in the past done monitoring where we use certain carbon fractions as markers for wood smoke, but I don't believe we're employing those in our regular monitoring stations. This would be, and I think the monitoring you're referencing is one of our regulatory monitors. It's one of the ones that measures ambient concentrations across the region, not specifically in a community. So yeah. That might help you, Jerry.
Yeah, I mean the monitoring stations that we have in that area are you know, they're designed to feed into our knowledge of the region. So, and the overall air quality of the region. And you can use it for some local scale, but not necessarily, you know, community scale, like we're talking about with 617 or something else. So we don't do that particular monitoring site. I'd have to get more information for you on it and get back to you on what we're actually measuring and what type of speciation.
So how do we know what the wood smoke, if we don't have that on our monitors?
So we do have general measurement for particulate matter on the monitors themselves. Where we do kind of suspect wood smoke, we have other methods of measurement. We can deploy different types of monitors there. We have our inspectors doing visual investigation. And then we do track in certain communities by the different type of carbon that's emitted. That's how we speciate the sources of what we would say wood smoke versus carbon that would be coming off of diesel generators and those other things. So the reason why you're hearing us hesitate is we're not certain whether we're doing that at that particular location or not. But we can come back to you on that.
Thank you.
Director Mitchell.
Thank you. And I appreciate the responses to John's questions, because, all right, I need a little primer here. We've got Rule 1215. It talked about fence line monitoring. The community wasn't that thrilled with it, so now we're doing adding community monitors. You mentioned three refineries. I'm using the word exempted, but maybe that's not the correct term. So which of the three are they? How do they not fall under 1215? Is it just on the community monitoring? Talk to me about these three refineries and why they don't come under 1215. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
All of the refineries are subject to 1215.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
So you mentioned there were three refineries that something. That's what I'm trying to find.
Okay. Well, let me start first with the community monitor, so that we eliminate the confusion around that. When we originally proposed these rules many, many moons ago, one of the things we wanted to do was have the refineries site and operate monitors in the communities around them. That quickly became
unworkable. Right, the community didn't like that.
Well, not only did the community not like it, neither did the refineries, and we ended up in this situation where it made no sense to continue forward with that path. So what we did was we decided to site and operate those monitors as the district.
Correct.
And we charge a fee to the refineries to recover the costs of that. So that's all already baked into our process. Those are independent of the refineries. They're not on site, and they'll be operated by us. But the fence line monitors are on the refinery's property or nearby, usually on the property, and so those are operated by the refineries. None of the refineries are exempt from any of the requirements of 1215. Now, I think Mr. Bovee can probably answer your question about what the three refineries he was referring to were with better precision.
That would be helpful, yes.
The specific refineries are Chevron, I believe Shell, and Valero. They had previous instrumentation there. What we are doing is looking at that instrumentation they have in place and determine whether or not it met the needs of 1215 and what enhancements needed to be employed in order to get them up to the specification that we were interested
okay.
in for 1215.
All right, thank you. So, you had these community meetings in February and March of a year ago. I think I understood you to say that each community has perhaps different kinds of concerns based on what pollutants are there, so you're looking for the appropriate type of monitor to find that. I guess my question is, why is it taking so long to find that if a year ago, 12 to 14 months ago, you went out, and was that just to determine where as opposed to what? So the what is what's driving trying to find the appropriate piece of equipment to do the instrumentation?
It's both. It's the where and it's the what. Primarily, it's the where. I mean, because we were getting community input on where they thought the problems existed and where they thought the monitors should be located. And part of that was through the workshops that we did, and then very useful comment that we got from them afterwards.
I guess where I'm going is it just seems, and Mr. Bunger just mentioned, a fee has been collected, but if there are no, if there's no instrumentation up yet, I'm hoping that that fee is sitting in some sort of reserve account. It's, I mean, well, I understand staff time,
yeah.
But...
So imagine you're in a community, and the community says, we think a problem is located here. It's on the corner of 14th and Main, right? Now, on the Air District side, we need to see how we can get a location there. That means we need to find a location, enter into lease agreements, get power, get contractors, buy the equipment that needs to be located there. So over the past years, we've been building towards that. We're buying the equipment, we're working on the sites, we're getting all of those things lined up. So these are not cheap systems either. They're you know, on average about $1.5 million per. So the fees that we're collecting cover our cost to get all of that set up. And as we implement these, the costs basically barely cover what we're going to need to put in terms of the equipment that we're siting and locating.
Okay. So the next question I have is, Director Joya asked for a timeline relative to the community monitoring. 2021 is 2 years off. Why? I get land use. I get trying to find the right location. I get instrumentation. But that, from 2016, and I know that wasn't the exact start date, but that's 5 years. And I'm just wondering why. Is there any way to speed that up so that, you know, we're looking maybe next summer, July of 2020? It just seems 2021, unless you're talking January, is way far off. And maybe you can come back to the committee and give us a little bit more on, I'll call it a Gantt chart, you know, where you are today, what the plan is for the next quarter and the next quarter, and what the problems are, so that we can see, and at least for me, better understand why it will take so long. If you've gone out, you've found out where they want it, you've got to do all the things that Damien was just talking about for siting, and then you're also working on parallel track with finding the right instrumentation to do the work in that community. Again, you're the experts, I'm the layperson, but that just seems way far off. So that would be helpful for a future meeting. Thank you.
Other questions? I guess I have a couple. Thank you very much for your report. I wondered, in terms of community monitoring, given that wind conditions around these refineries are variable, right? The direction changes from time to time and all. Does it make any sense to employ the inexpensive technology we see from the likes of Purple Air that give us the ability to cover a broad area with no infrastructure necessary? I know in my city we have up on 5 city poles a sensor that's all self-contained. It uses
cellular service to get in and out. There's a battery plus a solar panel on top of it, and I know that it couldn't possibly be used for enforcement actions, but it is a pretty, you know, if you have enough of them with some redundancy, I think we get a pretty good view of where the hotspots are in the community for basic things like PM and all. Just wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Because
they can go up in a day,
yes,
right?
Yeah, they can. Those monitors are useful to inform us and give us some direction on where we need to apply our efforts and direct our assets to get more comprehensive, more accurate, more defensible data. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, they have usefulness. As far as, you know, if we're looking, the community monitoring systems that we're trying to actually install are going to be wrapped into our network of monitoring stations. So they're going to meet the same EPA standards that the rest of our network is going to meet.
Right, and that's great, right? It takes a long time. We have all these siting conditions. They're expensive. And I know that, right, given variable winds down, what's downwind of a facility, whether it's a refinery or these other stationary sources that you showed on the map, landfills and other things, you know, it can take you have to, if your sensors are $1.5 million apiece plus operating cost, it takes a long time, it's expensive. And what I'm noting on the map is in some of the more affluent communities in the Bay Area, residents have put these things up, but in places like Richmond, they're sparser. So would we be better off trying to put some of these up under, you know, our auspices, again, not to use for enforcement, but just to get a denser network of monitors that might help point us toward those places and communities around stationary sources that are problematic, that might help us better cite our expensive official monitors.
Director Sinks, if I might, those sensors that you're talking about are particle counters. Mm-hmm. And so they do provide useful kind of relative information, mm-hmm. But it's important to have them anchored by what we call federal reference monitors, mm-hmm. to give us that regulatory quality data. And that's what we're planning to do in the refinery communities, is get that regulatory quality data. The other issue that we have with the low-cost sensors is that they typically don't measure a lot of the compounds that we're concerned about from refineries specifically. Mm-hmm. So I think
the organics and things.
Yeah, the organics, the volatiles, semi-volatiles. There's a lot of concerns about, for example, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, okay. which are a key health risk, and you've really got to have some high-quality equipment to measure those accurately. So we do see the low-cost sensors as part of an overall strategy for characterizing air quality and air quality variation at a greater geographic resolution. Mm-hmm. So there's a role for those low-cost sensors, there's a role for the mobile monitoring, and then there's a role for the regulatory quality sensors. And so the goal for the community monitoring in the refinery communities right now is to get those regulatory quality monitors stood up in a way where we can get the high-quality data and have a long-term measurement in the same location, so that you can do apples to apples, sure. trends comparisons. But yeah, your point is well taken. We do see a role for the low cost monitors, but the focus of the presentation today is really on those regulatory monitors.
Yeah, I understand. So for example, 5 years from now, how many regulatory quality monitors would you expect to see around any one of our Bay Area refineries?
We're planning to put up one in each refinery community.
Right, and so if the wind direction shifts and there's an incident, we could miss that completely, right?
Go ahead.
I think incident response is a separate issue.
Yeah. Okay.
And we can come back and talk to you all in detail about incident response, but that's a that's a very particular need that you're not going to be able to address with any stationary monitor. So there needs to be a more comprehensive strategy to address that, and we have been working with CARB on that, and we can come back with a presentation more specifically on incident response. But that's a separate question than what we're talking about today, which is characterizing the long-term exposure of refinery communities.
I get it. And so none of these small monitors is able to help us with VOCs at this point?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
It's but you have to remember, if you cast your mind back in Jerry's presentation, we have in-stack monitors, we have inspectors in the field, we have fence line monitors, we've got ground level monitors, we have now got community and fence line monitoring, and we've got the ACLIMA study that was going to measure street by street.
Right. Yeah.
So we're feeling that, you know, by this time next year, we're going to have a lot of data that will allow us then to, you know, zero in on areas where we might have problems and do regulation.
No, good point. So the ACLIMA study will also help us with this. Okay. More questions? Comments? Yeah.
I'll just say I think what's really promising is the additional monitors that are going to be and measurements that occur in Richmond as a result of AB 617 are going to give even a more thorough picture of where pollution sources are coming from. What's from a refinery? What are from mobile sources? Mm-hmm. What are from other types of stationary facilities? And ultimately, that type of monitoring network is going to be most useful for all of us and for the community. So if any of the other refinery communities eventually become an AB 617 community in the future, right, that opportunity will be presented at that time.
And I think, Director Joy, there's a lot of methodologies that we'll be developing in Richmond.
What we learn there can be applied. That's right.
Whether those communities are designated as AB 617 communities or not.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Great. Do we have any cards from the public on this? No. Nobody has any more, then we can move on to our next agenda item. So we're on to agenda item 5, an update on implementation of refinery regulations. Welcome. Nicholas, and you're going to introduce yourself.
Yeah. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Sinks and members of the committee. My name is Nicholas Maiden. I'm a manager within the engineering division. I oversee the section that's responsible for evaluating permit applications from some of the more complex facilities, including the local petroleum refineries. Today, I'll give a brief update on the implementation of two refinery-affected regulations, Regulation 12, Rule 15, Petroleum Refinery Emissions Tracking, and Regulation 6, Rule 5, Particulate Emissions from Fluidized Catalytic Cracking Units. And just in case you're not familiar or an expert in FCC use, I will be also giving some background information that may be helpful. At a basic level, a petroleum refinery receives material either raw, such as crude oil, or semi-processed, such as gas oil, stores it, cleans it, processes it, blends processed materials, and finally ships products out of a refinery. A refinery is compartmentalized by equipment configuration and purpose, with such compartments called process units. Typically, the first process unit at a refinery is a crude unit, where crude oil is separated by boiling points. And lighter materials, shown in green in the chart or diagram, or medium materials shown in orange and heavy materials shown in brown, are sent for further processing at various process units throughout the refinery. Each refinery is unique, and no refinery has the same number or type of process units. Each refinery also has hundreds of thousands of emission points, with some including combustion sources, storage tanks, process units with exhaust stacks, and equipment leaks. Crude oil is a generic term used to describe a soup of material comprising hundreds of compounds of inorganic and inorganic, including salts and metals. And although there are over a dozen parameters tracked for crude oil, two parameters are typically used to describe crude oil: API gravity and sulfur content. API gravity is used to determine the weight of petroleum liquids in relation to water, and is inversely related to density. Higher density equals a lower API gravity. To meet regulatory constraints and prevent corrosion of equipment, sulfur content is tracked. more sulfur, higher sulfur crude oil is called sour, and lower sulfur materials or crude oil is called sweet. API gravity is also used as a way to describe, to determine, to estimate the amount of processing effort that will be required to convert crude oil to valuable products. Heavy crude oils are more viscous and will require more processing than lighter crude oils. Crude oils are then classified as light sweet, light sour, heavy sweet, or heavy sour. In addition, crude oils are also classified by their origin, so Alaska North Slope or San Joaquin Valley. However, even crude oil from the same oil field, as shown in the bottles in the picture, can have a wide variation in composition. Each refinery, with its various number and types of process units, is configured to be optimized to run a certain crude window with narrow parameters, with a narrow window. Although each refinery is configured for that narrow range of parameters, they can purchase any crude oil with any kind of property, blend them for their process unit, for the refinery. Historically, the five local refineries have been configured to run California crude oil mixed with the Alaska North Slope. However, with declining reserves, as well as market forces, refineries have purchased more of the crude oil from foreign sources, shown in blue in the diagram.
Does that include Canada? Is foreign
yes.
Canada?
Foreign is everything outside of the U.S.
Thank you.
All foreign source crude oil is tracked to individual refineries and made publicly available by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. As such, we can know the exact amount and origin of foreign source crude oil to each of the five local refineries. A review of the published data for the past 10 years shows that the majority of foreign source crude oil is coming from Saudi Arabia and Ecuador, with small amounts from Canada.
I can't differentiate Iraq from Ecuador in the color scheme here, so...
Iraq's
yes. on the top and Ecuador is the one at the bottom.
Correct.
Okay. Just, okay. Picking colors of more contrast could be
sorry.
Helpful.
Sorry.
I like that blue too.
Noted. In previous board meetings, members of the public have expressed concerns regarding the local refineries processing imported crude oil from Canada, and in particular, crude oil derived from oil sands. A review of historical data shows that the percentage of total imported crude oil into the United States as a whole is increasing. That's from Canada. For calendar year 2017, approximately 43% of all crude oil imported into the United States came from Canada. However, the local refineries imported 57% from foreign sources, and of that 57%, 4.4% was from Canada. When accounting of the total crude use from both U.S. and foreign sources, local refineries imported only 2.5% from Canada.
Do you have all of these profiles by individual refinery as well?
I could.
You do? Yeah. Just in the future?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. As an acknowledgement of declining reserves of historical crude oil, sources, namely California, and in response to public concerns regarding potential emission impacts of sourcing crude oil from unconventional sources such as the Canadian oil sands and shale oil, Regulation 12, Rule 15 was adopted by the Board of Directors in December of 2015. Regulation 12, Rule 15 will allow the Air District to track refinery emissions over time through both annual emissions inventories and fence line monitoring. These emissions can then be compared with crude oil composition reports that will allow the Air District to ascertain if there are any potential correlations between crude oil quality and refinery emissions. Every June 30th, subject facilities are required to report an annual inventory of criteria, toxics, and greenhouse gas emissions. Because of the recently adopted AB 617 Criterion Toxics Reporting Regulation, the Air District is currently reviewing a potential change to the June 30th deadline. This will allow the refineries to submit a single submittal for both AB 617 and 1215 purposes. Each inventory is required to include emissions from all stationary sources, permitted and exempt, and required to be compiled per Air District Emissions Inventory Guidelines. For each submittal, the Air District and subject facilities each have 45 days to identify and address any deficiencies in the inventories. The regulation applies to both petroleum refineries and support facilities, where a support facility is defined as either a hydrogen plant, sulfuric acid plant, or electrical generation plant, where more than 50% of the production output supplies a refinery. As such, there are currently 5 petroleum refineries and 3 support facilities subject to the regulation. Since the rule was adopted, emissions inventories for 2 years have been submitted, and the Air District is currently reviewing data from the most recently submitted inventory. Due to both the complexity involved and the infancy of the program, both the preparation and review of the emissions inventories are a continually evolving effort. The Air District expects final approval and posting of inventories to occur once the heavy liquids fugitive studies is done later this year. In addition to reporting annual emissions, the rule requires the refineries to produce a monthly crude slate report where various parameters are tracked for imported crude oil or crude oil blends fed to a crude unit, as well as imported non-crude oil materials fed to a fluidized catalyst processing unit, provided those amounts exceed certain monthly thresholds. The refineries are also required to report a monthly average for API gravity, sulfur content, vapor pressure in the case of crude oil, and sulfur and metals content, iron, nickel, and vanadium. However, this information is considered confidential business information by the refineries, and where supporting data is used to derive the monthly averages are kept on site, and Air District staff visit the refineries and review the data there. Since the rule was adopted, average values for the various parameters were determined for a baseline period of calendar years 2013 to 2016, and Air District staff have visited each of the 5 refineries and reviewed monthly data for calendar years 2017 and 2018. The Air District staff is currently evaluating the compositional data in conjunction with emissions data. However, the data is too preliminary for any useful conclusions.
I wonder, Mr. Chair, yes. Could you repeat what you just said about the confidential information?
Yes, the refineries treat the specific material, their raw feedstock materials, as confidential. And the reason being that they purchase materials on an open market, and if it was publicly available, there are crude traders that can kind of would know that material, purchase it, and drive up the price.
So when they report, they report to you, and then we keep it confidential as well, the report that we receive?
With respect to the crude characteristics, the arrangement that we have worked out to avoid some of the problems around this is that we go out to the facilities, we inspect the materials that they have, we collect the information and do the calculation that we need to determine what those crude characteristics are, and then we have that in our possession so that we don't have this problem of having the sensitive information in our possession.
Thank you.
And I just want to follow up. And so we are getting the information as a district that we need. Is that correct, Mr. Bunger?
Yes, that's 100% correct.
Great, thank you.
Although the individual refinery crude data is considered confidential business information, aggregated data for the 5 refineries that was previously presented by the California Energy Commission is not. From the CEC data on the chart on the left, we see a trend of crude oil shifting slightly lighter, increasing API gravity, and more sour, increasing sulfur content. When this data is combined with imported Canadian crude oil properties, the chart on the right, we see how the majority of imported Canadian crude oils had API gravity and sulfur content far outside of the annual averages for the local refineries. Unfortunately, there isn't public information regarding the properties of materials fed to fluidized catalyst processing units at the local refineries. After the crude unit, fluidized catalytic cracking unit, or FCCU, is one of the most important.
Raising my hand here. I got a question.
Sure.
Could you go back to that previous slide? Hi.
Go back. Yes. Just in.
I know, now I can't see it though, because I could see myself. The slide, you made a comment, I'm looking at slide 13, thank you, I'm looking at slide 13. You made a comment that you said, unfortunately, we are not able to receive. Can you finish that sentence in relation to that slide?
No, I did not. The comment was that, unfortunately, we do not have publicly available information regarding the properties of materials fed to a fluidized catalyst processing unit, similar to the crude unit data that we're showing on this slide. So I don't have
Why don't we?
Basically, we have that information. We just can't show it publicly because it does tell a story.
Yes, it does tell the story, and I think we ought to push back on that. Because what we're doing then is withholding information from the public about the type of crude oil that's being processed here in the Bay Area and the quality that impact their health. So it doesn't make any sense that we're not able to.
Well, there's a second portion of the presentation today that talks about the emissions from fluidized catalytic crackers and how we are monitoring that. So... the monitoring is happening. We are, by looking at the inputs, understanding, and looking at the outputs, we're able to understand that those impacts are not happening. So we can, by surrogate, show that we are monitoring the emissions from these facilities and monitoring the emissions from those units.
Okay. I'm just... concerned that they can keep that information from us, especially since
they're not keeping the information from us. It's simply not public information. That's the point we're trying to make, is that the information is, since we have the information, we collect it at the facilities. That's what we were talking about with Directors Groom and Canepa. We do have that information. We just can't share it publicly.
Okay, well, that's a problem for me, because we're here to regulate the quality of the air and the toxicity of some of these emissions from these refineries, yet we've got confidential information that we can't share with the public. So
I want to
make a point that there's a problem with that.
On the emission side, of course, we report that information, and that's what we're about to talk about. The Air District actually handles quite a large volume of confidential business information. This is among many, many, many pieces of it that we have. State law protects that information from public disclosure for fairly clear reasons, I think. So we are working the best we can to have the information for regulatory purposes without violating that principle.
Okay, fine. But we still need to explain, going back to the slide, why the API keeps getting worse over the last few years. I mean, Jack told me 3 months ago that the type of crude oil that they're importing or exporting from Canada is dirtier than what it has been in the past. And that is being processed in the Bay Area, not in Canada. So... anyway, we should go back to that slide at some point and talk about that in terms of the API. Thank you.
Well, the API is telling us that the crude's getting lighter.
Correct.
And the sulfur weight is telling us crude is getting more sour.
But how does this correspond to having dirtier crude from the tar oil sands, which was reported on earlier in the year?
Yeah, I think that we showed in an earlier slide that the amount of that oil that's being imported to the Bay Area is remaining pretty constant at a pretty low rate, below 2.5% of the total crude input to these facilities. So while what Mr. Broadbent said was correct, it's because the amount is so small, and we can see that through this regulation and through these information sources, we can be assured that the emissions are not rising as a result of that particular input to our facilities.
I think if you put slide 6 up again, it's aggregate information, but it does give us the overview that may answer some of your questions, Director Zane.
Yeah, it's confusing because you have to kind of derive the actual impacts from it, given that it says 94% on the left. in the table above the graph, and then it basically pulls it down on the right to 2.5 in terms of out of that percentage. So anyway, work on the slide. It's not very clear. And I'm responding to the slide based upon what Jack has presented to us in the past as well.
So just to, so I understand the slide. So you're saying 94% in 2017, 94% of Canadian crude coming into the U.S. comes out of the tar sands.
Mm-hmm. It's either whole or part. So that's from the CEC data set. That's originally from ARB's data. And the way
that mean in whole or in part?
Well, what they'll do is if they take a small amount of crude oil from oil sands and blend it with a large amount,
yeah,
they call that
right.
as oil
yeah,
sands.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. So in a sense, it's the source, it's either, obviously, tar sands can be blended in with other sources. So got it. Yes, I understand that.
My recollection is much of those oil sands end up in gas in the Midwest,
right?
Yes,
of the United States.
That's right. Why the U.S. number is at 43.24%, right? So the bulk of that goes into the middle of the country because that's the more straight path for it to go. And, you know, with activities in Vancouver limiting terminals and that sort of thing, there just isn't available.
So basically you're saying 2.5% of the total crude oil that local refineries import is from Canada.
Correct. And then teasing out how much of that is oil sands versus conventional is a little bit more complex.
Yeah, right.
All right. Great. Would you like to continue where you were?
Okay. Well, picking up, after the crude unit, a fluidized catalytic cracking unit, or FCC, is one of the most important process units at a refinery and accounts for the majority of gasoline production. However, an FCCU is also the single largest single emitting source at a refinery where, depending on the pollutant, an FCCU can account for up to 70% of emissions of that pollutant. An FCCU converts heavy oils to lighter oils by cracking them in the presence of catalyst and heat. Heavy oils are mixed with fresh catalyst in a riser, the vertical pipe on the right. They react to split into lighter oils in the reactor while used catalyst flows to a regenerator. During the reaction, coke particles cover the catalyst, reducing its efficacy. In order to regenerate the used catalyst, the coke particles, as well as any residual hydrocarbons, are burned off the used catalyst in the regenerator. And once regenerated, fresh catalyst flows down to the riser to repeat the cycle. However, regenerating the catalyst creates significant emissions, primarily particulate matter, NOx, sulfur dioxide, and carbon monoxide. To reduce particulate matter emissions, the refineries will often use an electrostatic precipitator, or ESP, which uses electricity to ionize the exhaust gas stream. Ionized particles are then collected on plates and removed from the exhaust. To reduce the electrical resistance of these particles, ammonia will often be injected before the ESP, and that will improve the particulate matter removal efficiency of the ESP. However, ammonia reacts with other pollutants to form particulate matter after the ESP. Therefore, there's a balance between injecting just enough ammonia to improve ESP performance while not injecting too much that ammonia-formed particulate matter exceeds the amount removed by the ESP. In air district source tests conducted at a local FCCU, the air district found that a significant portion of particulate matter emissions from the FCC, over 95%, were condensable particulate matter. And in subsequent analysis, they determined that the condensable particulate matter was a result of ammonia injection. To ensure the proper balance of ESP performance and ammonia injection, the Air District developed Regulation 6, Rule 5, which was adopted by the Board of Directors in December 2015. The rule requires ammonia emissions monitoring and complying with either a daily limit of 10 parts per million by volume ammonia at 3% oxygen, or to conduct ammonia optimization to find the minimum amount of ammonia injection rate necessary to minimize total PM2.5 emissions. Of the five refineries, one refinery, Phillips 66, is not subject because it doesn't have an FCCU. And one refinery, Valero, is exempt because it has a wet gas scrubber. Of the three other refineries, Marathon, formerly Endeavor, formerly Tesoro, has decided to comply with the daily ammonia limit, and Chevron and Shell have decided to conduct ammonia optimization. Sure. Chevron conducted 16 months of ammonia optimization, and preliminary data shows potential for significant PM emission reductions. Shell also conducted ammonia optimization, and Air District staff is reviewing the submitted information. There's also a current rule development effort for further particulate matter emission reductions for this rule. Regulation 6, Rule 5, was identified in AB 617 Expedited Best Available Retrofit Control Technology, or BART, implementation schedule. Air District staff are conducting a technical assessment, stakeholder engagement, and outreach. We anticipate workshops in early 2020 and a board hearing by the end of 2020. And with that, I conclude my presentation. If you have any other questions.
Questions on this? Director Ross.
Thank you. And thank you, Nicholas, for the presentation. So I know that the refineries are, that we have in the Bay Area are pretty much set to cook their own formula in their own kitchens, and they've got the equipment in the kitchens to do what they usually do.
Yes.
I noticed, or I read something lately, that there is, although there's a lot of, the U.S. is producing a lot of shale oil, and it's lighter, there's still going to be an increasing heavy demand for the distillates that come from heavier crudes.
Yes, that's correct. As they noted earlier, each refinery is set up differently. Our refineries are considered complex, so they're designed to process the most heavy sour materials. So unfortunately, they can process a little bit of shale oil mixed in with some heavier oils. If they were to primarily process shale oil, they would not be optimizing their refinery. There would be some process units that would be at full production and others that would not be. And so due to their market demand, they wouldn't be as profitable as they could be as they're currently configured.
So they want to continue, they would, it's more profitable to go through the process, economically more profitable to do a heavy crude and get a variety of products than a lighter crude and get a fewer number of products. And their business model is pretty much geared toward the more efficient, if you can use that word, production of a multiplicity of products rather than going to a cleaner but less versatile marketplace of a lighter crude. So I guess it's an economic question that they probably are more.
It's not necessarily the product mix as much as it is the ability to run the units at capacity. So every refinery is configured to run some window of crude, and that was that one of the diagrams earlier showed you why the scatter plot ends up in the middle of a ring, is that that's where our refineries are. They were originally built to run California crude, which is heavy, sour garbage. It's among the worst.
Some of the
crudes.
Crappiest on earth.
Yeah.
And we tar the Canadians, but we get...
Right. So if a refinery is configured to run that, it doesn't necessarily have light ends capacity to deal with lighter crudes, and it doesn't necessarily have enough sulfur capacity. It depends on the facility to run. You know, so you run out of space on those ends of the spectrum. So the refinery is most efficient when it's being fed the diet of oil that it's designed to run. It can run at capacity in all of its units. If you start going too light, you can't run as much of it because you run out of capacity to handle it. If you go too heavy, you can't run as much because you run out of your capacity on that end. Yeah, so it's not so much the product mix as it is the inputs and the engineered facility.
Yeah, I get that. They want to use all the pots and pans in their kitchen and the cookie sheet too.
And reconfiguring is not a trivial task.
Right. And so I guess what I'm getting at is they're not economically inclined to change it to a more lighter crude because they get fewer products out of the lighter crude. Everything else being equal, I mean, even if they're not going to willingly do it because they want to be able to make a lot more money off of a lot, producing a lot, a wider variety of products.
I think so long as the inputs are available, they're likely to stay what they're engineered to run. And when those inputs dry up or become mm-hmm. different enough, if we still have demand for petroleum products, there will be reconfiguration. That's the nature of the business.
Okay, so the another question that I had was, I know that Director Zane was, hi Shirley, I know that Director Zane was asking about the information, and I know that it's kept private, but couldn't the marketers that we fear having the information and then, you know, adjusting the price accordingly to the purchasers they have on hand, aren't they able to figure out over time what, who's buying what from the shippers, from the producers? I mean, it can't be that much of a secret at some point. I mean, I understand our need to be confidential, but it seems to me like if they really wanted to know, they could probably figure it out through their own means. We're not going to help them, but...
Whether or not people could figure it out, we're constrained by state law not to release certain information. So, there's probably smart people who can figure this out. There's probably people making money in the oil spot market, but we're not allowed by state law to assist them.
No, I get that. I mean, we're constrained, and that's fine with me. We want to maintain that confidentiality because we want to be a trusted partner in all this endeavor. But I think the notion that they don't know. They probably can't, even if they could figure out what they want, the brokers are probably constrained by their own market forces and their own ability to do it. So it keeps being brought up that this would be the secrecy is really important because they'll get charged more. I think it's an interesting asterisk, but I don't think that, I think we talk about it a little bit more than I think it really has saliency. So that's my pontification for today. But I reserve the right.
Right to pontificate more. Okay, good. Anybody else? Do we have any members of the public that wish to comment?
Not for this item.
Thank you. I'm heartened on slide 19 to see that Regulation 6, Rule 5 will result in some optimizations and limits that actually improve the particulate matter emissions, if I understand correctly, by optimizing ammonia at least one or two facilities. So is that correct?
Yes, and even though we're in the process of evaluating what that final number should be, the refineries aren't simply sitting around waiting. They're actually already optimizing the ammonia because they don't want to emit the particulate matter more than needed. And so we've already have seen a significant drop, and now the question is whether how much more of a drop can we get?
Yeah, so we have a positive. This connects to a positive health impact to communities downwind of refineries.
Yes, it's one of the parameters that we track are metals. Iron, nickel, vanadium, that's considered a particulate matter. So any kind of decrease in particulate matter is going to also have a reduction in any toxic air contaminants that are in a particulate format.
Great. So it's always fascinating to learn about new things. For those of us up here, we've learned about I've been computing up here in nonlinear differential equations associated with plume dynamics, and now you've introduced us to ESP today, so I'm feeling oh so much smarter. Quap. And crap. Yeah, I mean, yes, quap. Thank you very much. How could I forget? If there's nothing further, then thank you very much, Nicholas. Okay. So once again, we have public comment on non-agenda matters. Any cards?
I do have Bob Brown.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Sinks and members. Bob Brown with Western States Petroleum Association. And
Just had a question, and this pertains to something that Director Ross had raised, I think, a couple months ago, asking of the district for a permitting flowchart, just to kind of see how things work through the process in terms of timing and how things work together in terms of approving the permits put forth. So thank you.
Thank you. Director Ross?
Yeah, beat me to the punch, Bob. I was going to bring that up at, when we had our comments. Thanks.
Very good.
So, we have one designed, and we've been getting ready to talk to some of our communities about permitting. So it's an app comment, and hopefully we can bring it back to your next meeting.
That's great. Any other director comment? No. So we have a couple of options for our next meeting. We are scheduled to go in July on the 15th. I've asked district staff to poll for either July 15th or June 17th. June 17th or July 15th. And I think preliminarily at that meeting, we're talking more about particulate matter and maybe even permitting. So.
Correct.
Yeah. So. Well, there was some debate about whether it ought to be June or July, and I don't know if you all have a preference.
But July 15th is during the National Association of Counties annual conference. I would not suggest that because many county supervisors.
Which date is that? I'm sorry.
July 15th. Many county supervisors may go to that.
Okay.
We'll take that as direction. We'll send the poll with both dates, and when you say no, hopefully you'll say yes to the other one.
It's just that it's hard asking a date in which is it during a conference of one of the government associations that half the members of the board are on.
So I'm going to second that, John. Don't even put that out there. I would say to the staff, because we're not available. So that's going to be a problem for all of us.
So June 17th. Is the other date that we are holding.
Mr. Chair, June 17th for David and I is our county budget hearings. Okay. So we won't be able to be here.
Let us do this. We'll pick another couple of dates and poll. It's probably easier than doing it on the fly.
Right.
So we'll poll for other dates in June and July.
Yeah.
Right.
All right.
Thank you.
Very good. Director Mitchoff? No, okay. Very good. So we will poll for our next date, presumably in June or July. And if there's nothing further, then I'll take a movement to adjourn. Thank you. Second. Adjourned we are.
Thank you.
All right.